Nice to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today. Before we get started with our garden talk, I did want to mention that this Sunday, Wisconsin Public Radio is hosting an open house. You may have heard a little bit about it. Maybe you haven't. I hope you can make it. We'll be meeting at Buck Studio on the 7th floor of Vilas Hall. That's our home for Wisconsin Public Radio. In Madison from 10 until noon. Doesn't cost anything to come in. Everybody's welcome. And hoping to have Talk of the Nation host Neil Conan there. I'll be there. Jim Packard will be there. Joy Cardine, Ben Marins, Michael Feldman, Tom Martin Erickson, Cheryl Gasser, Eileen Eisenberg, so a whole and more. So a lot of us will be there. It's, as I said, an open house, 10 to noon. Come and go. You don't have to stay the whole time if you don't want to. We'll have some little panel talks sporadically through that time period, so you get to ask questions. But, hey, you can ask me a question. Hey, just come right on up to me and ask a question. I'll be glad to answer it. Jim Packard will, and everybody else, too. So this Sunday from 10 until noon, the 7th floor of Vilas Hall. Come on in. Say hi. Glad to meet you. And if you want to join in and have a question for Bob Tomash on this edition of Garden Talk, I hope you'll do that too. Bob's right sitting across from me here in the studio. He's a senior lecturer in the Department of Horticulture at UW-Madison and UW Extension. And we're really pleased to have Bob with us. He comes by pretty often to talk about all things gardening. And if you have a question, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. In Madison at 263-1890. Bob, welcome back.
Hey, it's good to be back, and it's warm, and there's no snow in here.
Yeah, there's no snow inside the studio, and it was a lot of it outside the studio. What are we, I think in southern Wisconsin, at least, some parts of southern Wisconsin, got some potential problems because we had some rain and then freezing.
Right. Last weekend, they had 12 inches of snow forecast for us, so we luckily only got about 3.5 or 4, but the other came in the form of precipitation or rain, and that soaked right down through the snow that was there. And I was out doing a little digging the other day, not that I was stuck or anything, but I was out in the lawn, and what's interesting is that there's about a 2 or 3 inch layer of slush or almost frozen rain. And so that potentially can lead to some problems, nothing that we can really do about it except hope for the best here. I would say the biggest problem would probably be on the lawns. We'll see a little more snow mold there and some of those diseases, so don't be too anxious to get out there to rake off your lawn this year. Wait till the top is definitely dry and then go out and do something.
And go out and do something. Okay. Well, I'll tell you what, Tim in Madison's been waiting for a little while, so let's get to him. Hi, Tim.
Hi, how you doing?
Great. Thanks for calling.
Yeah. Hey, listen, early January when we had that melting thing going on, I got a window well that kind of down in my basement that leaks like a faucet, and I had to work really hard to get that leak plugged. But here's what I'm thinking of doing come spring. I'm thinking about getting just a bunch of dirt and filling in that window well. And then what I was thinking of doing was maybe putting in some kind of maybe a grass or a plant of some sort that kind of maybe can spread a little bit. You know, it kind of does its own thing, but it's drought resistant but has long roots so that if it did rain or did get, you know, wet, that it would soak up the roots would soak up the water. And it kind of wouldn't mind if it rained or it didn't rain. Is there anything like that that would be good for something like that?
No, you've got a problem that's structurally definitely there. Yeah. Even if you plug up that window, cement it in, you've still got the seam between the old concrete and the present concrete. And
Tim.
Yeah, I mean, the person that does the home renovation.
Oh, the home renovation people. Well, we got quite a few of them. John Merrill had done many of them, yeah.
But there are people that if you happen to have a dry window well, like you've described, actually set up what's called a hotbed in there, not to absorb the water or anything like that, but they take the heat out of the window, throw a kind of a window cover over it or a sash, and they actually start growing some of their transplants in that area. Mm-hmm. But what you have in mind, it's not going to fly, I don't think.
One of the things you can do, and I've seen those, are these sort of plastic, clear plastic almost like awnings that fit over and sort of cover that area. So if it rains, the water is just not going to get in there.
Yes, and he probably has a landscaping issue to deal with. And this is probably a good time to bring that up, is adjacent to buildings, if the slope of the soil is slightly towards the building, it's going to bring the water that comes off the roof or the rainwater or anything like that to the building, and then it's going to work its way down the wall. So doing a little bit of re-landscaping so that the water drains away. I know you've got a window well there. It's not only the cap that Larry's describing, but you also have a potential for water to seep around that steel structure or whatever is there, and so you're back at problem one again, lots of water to deal with. So the focus, at least with the landscape, the cover would be, it would keep the direct water coming out from going in, but try to slope the building away, the soil away from the building. We're usually saying that have at least a 1-inch slope for every 10 feet, and that's a minimum. We could even go a little bit larger than that.
Yep.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
Thanks, Tim.
Thank you.
You bet. Appreciate the call. Bob in Woodruff, your turn. Hi, Bob.
Hi. I'm looking for any tips on terminating really old seeds, like 4 or 5 years old, or any tips on storing seeds for as long as possible. And how long is it possible for seeds to last if you store them properly?
Well, there are certain varieties of seeds like cucumbers and that has a very short life, probably 3-4 years. But your question on storing of seeds, usually in a plastic container that they'd be dry, a Tupperware container, and placing it in your refrigerator in the crisper drawer is one place to be storing, and they'll last a lot longer. We often store a lot of our seeds in refrigerators and that type of thing. But keeping them dry, when it comes to doing some planting, to answer your other question, you can set out a certain number of seeds, and you can count the number that do germinate. Some, if you soak them in water for 3-4 hours and then plant them in that soil medium, they're going to imbibe more water and therefore start the whole germination process a little bit faster.
So soak them in water for a little bit first.
Yes. The small ones, that might be a bit of a challenge, but any of the larger seeds, beans and that, you'll actually see them begin to swell and crack. But usually anywhere from 2 to 4 hours does not hurt. You don't want to leave them in for a day or so because they're going to drown. They're going to run out of oxygen, and that leads to a whole series of other problems.
Yeah, and then, but other than just what's the right temperature, like 70?
For germinating?
Yeah.
Okay, germinating seeds, we're looking at least 65 degrees. Once they go through to start germinating, the root structure develops. Some people will take a heating pad, the old waterbed pads. The heating pads work very well, where you'd set your container on that, and it heats the soil medium up to 80-85 degrees, and that plant's going to do a lot better in a situation like that.
Okay. All right. Thanks. All right, thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Bob. Thank you for calling. Angie and Toma. Hello.
Hello, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
Hi, Mr. Tomesh. My question has to do with some overgrown arborvitae at home. They're, I would estimate, close to 30 feet, and they go far above the roof. And I'm wondering if there's any way to cut those back and rehabilitate them. And if it's okay, I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay.
Okay, with any evergreens, once you make the cut, they do not send up suckers or anything like that it's going to re-vegetate an area. So what's going to happen when you cut off that plant, let's say at 8 feet or something like that, hopefully to have it at the appropriate height, it's just not going to fill in properly or anything like that. It's going to be unsightly. So when you have some overgrown landscape plant materials like that, it's best to simply remove and start over with something else.
Okay, thank you very much for calling. And on to George in Ogama. George, hi.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question of last year at my place here. I found a white, totally white milkweed growing. And I was wondering what causes that. And it lasted about 2 weeks. And it was very lacy, the leaves. And the root system down towards the roots had a kind of a orangish, pinkish hue.
Hmm.
What is that all about?
Lost all its chlorophyll. Eh?
there could be a number of things going on there when you have that. When you told me about the laziness of the leaves, that's usually an indication that there's probably a virus involved. Viruses come in by insects that catch the airstream probably out of Colorado and then show up on our doorstep one day. So I'm guessing it it possibly was a virus that was causing it, that was impacting the chlorophyll, like Larry had just mentioned. And the plant probably did not survive very long unless it was connected to somebody else. And milkweeds have an underground rhizome that connects several plants, and so one healthy one might be feeding that nutrients, and so it'd keep it alive for a while. But what you described sounds like a potential virus issue.
Oh, okay. I do have pictures of it. It was very pretty, actually.
Yep.
And, well, thank you very
much. Yeah, thanks a lot for calling.
We see the viruses showing up, like in the aster yellows and carrots, for example. They'll develop kind of a whitish, orangish type leaf tissue, and that's one scenario. We have viruses that come into zucchini, of all things. And last year received a few calls. Oh, they taste terrible. They're bitter. They stink. And what it is a mosaic-type virus that gets into the plant and impacts the fruit and everything else. So we're seeing more and more virus issues as insects migrate in the upper air currents.
And that wouldn't hurt somebody eating that zucchini. I bet you that's a question that might.
Well, they wouldn't eat it because it smells so bad or tastes so bad. But usually, if we have a virus-infected plant, we encourage people to rogue out that plant, get rid of it, because other insects will then come in and feed on that plant. When they move over to your next garden plant, pretty soon everybody has it.
Everybody's got it. You can join in, too, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or in Madison at 263-1890. Give a call or email us at talk@wpr.org. Open lines, we'll get you on pretty fast. Let's go to Tom in Viroqua. Tom, hello.
Hi, good morning. I've planted a few apple trees, but all I can find are these small dwarf varieties, which are fine if your goal is really to you know, be harvesting apples, particularly at a commercial scale. But I'm really more interested in you know, shade trees and sort of vintage varieties, you know, that, I mean, there's always more apples than I can use, and if they fall and the deer eat them, well, that's fine, too. So it's, you know, what varieties are available and you know, for this climate, and where can you get them is the main question.
Well, what you're talking about, old apple varieties, there's Heritage Farms, which provides the organic seed sources. That one is going to start providing apples. If you do a Google search, there's old-time apples. You'll find that there's some nurseries out in Connecticut that provide those. St. Lawrence Nursery, I believe, is another one that you can usually access. As for the rootstocks, there are some advantages of dwarf rootstocks, and one is the fact that you have a smaller statured tree, but when you're dealing with deer, you might want the other hand to be operating. The other issue with the dwarf-type trees, they're more productive overall, and also they start producing fruit at a much earlier age. An example, if you took a seed from an apple and planted that, grafted onto that a domestic rootstock, you'd probably be waiting 10, 12 years before you had any fruit. And then some of us
are
might
gone.
Not be around waiting that long. And so that's why dwarf-type apples are more advantageous. But you can find the old-time varieties if that's what you're looking for. Do an internet search, and there's a number of sources for that available. Even some of the more common catalogs that you might receive will have a few old-time apples in there as well. The rootstock, that's your choice. There are some that are a little bit larger, like Malling 106 and Malling 111. Those are trees that are probably 90% stature. There's one out of a real very hardy rootstock called Antonovka that came out of, I believe, Russia, and that's another very hardy one. That has a tree stature, I think, of around 75%.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Tom, for calling. Bob Tomisch, our guest today, senior lecturer in the Department of Horticulture and with University of Wisconsin-Madison and UW Extension. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Net. Larry Mueller with my guest and friend, Bob Tomisch, senior lecturer in the Department of Horticulture at UW-Madison and UW Extension. Lots of people online, so let's go right back to the phones. And Linda in Pleasant Prairie, you are next. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Bob. Larry, I just want you to know I love your show. I love all your shows.
Thank you.
I have learned so many things I never knew before. But I'm calling. I know somebody called about arborvitae a little bit back, and I have a question. with all this snow that we have, I have these big, big bush arborvitaes. I've trimmed them before. They actually worked really well. But now they've been so weighed down with all the snow. I finally went out there and I took a bunch of the snow off. Are they going to be okay?
Yeah.
Well, we're waiting on the ice and see what that does. Sometimes yeah. That'll cause some browning. Really, with those types of shrubs, I know they look like they're really flattened out. I've got some yews that it's a snowbank.
Yeah.
And it's not even next to the house. Actually, just the normal melting process is going to lighten up the shrubbery, and it's going to come out of it. So a lot of times when we're in there digging, they're very brittle right now. If you're trying to shovel the snow off, you're going to have more breakage problems than anything else.
Okay.
So I just let nature take its course there.
All right.
Okay. I have one other question real quick. I'm sorry.
Sure.
When is the best time to separate, like, black-eyed Susan and perennials?
You're talking about doing some renovation.
Early, yeah, I want to move some around.
Yep.
Yeah.
Soon as the soil thaws this spring and it dries out just a little bit, you don't want to be puddling in mud. But
okay.
It's a good time to be dividing those types of perennials. Another rule they often say is perennials that flower in the fall move in the spring. Those that flower in the spring move them in the fall, meaning August and September. But that's a general rule. You can move them anytime if you treat them really nice, water them appropriately. But in the spring now is an excellent time to be moving these perennials around. One challenge when you move some, sometimes if they're a little bit, they dry out, the amount of flowers that you receive is going to be a little bit less that first year, and that can be a problem.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Linda, for calling. Appreciate it. And Shannon in Viroqua, we're on to you now. Hi, Shannon.
Hi, Larry. Thank you. My question is about artillery fungus.
Yeah, in mulch.
Yes, I've just discovered that's what I have. And I've read that mushroom compost layered on that mulch can eliminate that fungus. So I'm wondering how much mushroom compost
you heard that
to put down.
Okay. Have you heard that before,
I haven't
Bob?
Heard that, but it could be one fungus being detrimental to
the other fungus.
I'm
oh.
just guessing. I don't
yeah.
know for sure, and I
okay.
couldn't even respond to that.
Okay.
But your problem with the artillery fungus is that it sends these little spores, and they stick to the house and things
right.
that are unsightly. A few other things that you can do is take your mulch and kind of rake it, move it around it so it dries out on the top, and sometimes that'll reduce some of the mm-hmm. fungal issues, or just get rid of those as they emerge. But if you start, people say, well, I'll take the garden hose and really nail them. What you're doing is adding mm-hmm. water to the situation, and
you
it
don't
just
want
proliferates.
That.
No, mm-hmm. you want it to dry out if it possibly can.
Right. The spores that are on the house, do they have any kind of life cycle, or are they just, they're done?
They're done.
Okay.
It's got to fall on someplace that's got decomposing tissue or something like that, where they can actually have moisture and germinate.
Uh-huh.
On the house, they just look like they splat and stuck there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's the Penn State Extension website that I learned about the mushroom compost.
It is very possible. Like I said, it's
yeah.
one fungus. There are, when we have fungal problems, there are other fungi that are problematic to the others, and that's probably mm-hmm. in that cultured mushroom, it has some detrimental effect on the other ones. It maybe even feeds on that one. I don't know.
Okay. Thank mm-hmm. you, Bob.
Yep. Thanks, Shannon, for calling. Patricia in Madison, your turn. Hi, Patricia.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a huge white pine tree on my front lawn, and it will have to be coming down soon because of the enormity of the tree. And not only has it been a haven for birds, but it's given me wonderful privacy from picture windows of houses across the street. I was wondering if you could give me an idea of some favorable shrubs or trees that would be fast-growing and give me some type of screening in a short time. I've been considering putting in maybe a soil berm so they would be raised up and then putting these plantings in that.
Yeah, that's a choice. Sometimes even looking at trellising types of plants like wisteria and even grapevines and things like that, that'll give you some fairly good protection, at least during the summer months. Another thing is your berm idea is a fairly good one to raise it up, because you normally receive about 18 inches of growth on a tree. There are some that grow faster, like you'll find some of the seedless popple varieties. They're fast mm-hmm. growing, and you could, if you water, the secret is to water every 5 days on some of those, and you'll probably get 7 feet of growth in a year. You can really push those. There are some maples that grow very fast. What you might want to do is look at mixing a few of these things. Even watering something like a white pine regularly will enhance its growth to maybe 24 inches a year. So if you start out with a slightly taller one, and you need to, there's a rough formula when you water transplanted trees. For every inch of trunk diameter, you need to add about 12 gallons of water per inch of trunk diameter. So if you've got a 4-inch trunk, you're looking at about 48 gallons of water about every 5 days on that plant.
Well, the white pine I have is probably 50 feet tall now, and I don't know if I want to go the route of a white pine again.
No, I'm just giving that as a suggestion because that gives you a year-round protection. But look at the trellising idea. Go down to some of the botanical gardens that we have here in the Madison area or wherever you happen to be, and you'll see some trellised types of where they've got clematis and plant materials like that, and that'll give you that privacy fence that you might want.
I understand that for summer, but I guess it's the winter time. You know, it's the year-round.
Yeah. So there's, and the pine, you know, that's sort of, that gives the year-round, and there's not much else that gives the year-round.
No, the only the evergreens, most of those are not as fast growing, so that's always a problem. With by building an arbor or something like that, getting five-leaf ivy, wisteria, some of those types of plants growing there, you can get a dense enough vine canopy, if you want to call it that. That'll give you some type of protection during the winter months.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yep, thanks, Patricia. Tony in Middleton, your turn. Hi, Tony.
Hello. I've got fruit trees on our lawn. We're just right in Middleton. And some of them are, 7-plus years old. And I cannot get these to produce fruit. I've got several varieties of apple trees, pear, plum, and they're just not providing fruit. What might be the issue?
Well, one, when you fertilize your lawn, you're giving too much nitrogen to those plants, and that'll keep them in a vegetative stage. They look like they're real healthy and well-growing.
Right.
That's one problem that might happen. If you started out with standard-type rootstocks, remember I mentioned earlier that it takes about 12 years sometimes for some of those to start fruiting. Pears tend to be late fruiting anyway because we really do not have any good dwarf-type rootstocks that brings this precocious effect to that early production of fruit on the plant. So I would, one, cut back on your fertilizer program to your lawn. Another little trick that you can do is next, probably about the end of May, take and bend a branch down. So instead of pointing out horizontal, it's pointing in the downward direction, and you can weight it down with a, you know, a tie of some type. And leave it like that until about July 4th, or a little bit later. And what that does is it stimulates the amount of carbohydrates to be higher than the nitrogen level, and that'll stimulate flowering. If you look in some of the textbooks, look up girdling, where they take a jackknife on a branch, a scaffold branch. You kind of squeeze the jackknife or the knife in. You'll feel it cut through the bark, and you just make a ring all the way around. Don't do any peeling. And that wound, and you would do that around the 1st of June. When that wound occurs, the bark is what carries the sugars back to the root system. They're then trapped in that branch, and that higher sugar-to-nitrogen ratio will also stimulate flower buds for the following year. So there's little tricks that commercial growers do utilize to stimulate earlier production of fruit. So you can try some of those ideas.
Okay. One other question related to that. If I have gotten any fruit, the darn squirrels grab it, and it disappears.
Yeah.
Any idea to keep them away other than, you know, bagging the fruit or wrapping the whole tree in net?
Yeah, that's a problem. And they're probably not the only culprits. I've seen possum come in and raccoon and even some larger birds will pick on fruit. And it's usually more of a problem during the dry year, and last year we had a very dry year, and so they look at fruit like that as a moisture source. But some type of animal management, and there are some bulletins on controlling squirrels as well as possum and raccoon, and you might want to take a look at that. And that would be at the Learning Store. They could download it on a computer.
Through UW Extension.
Right.
Great, thank you.
All right, thanks for calling. So UW Extension, Learning Store, go there and get some information. Although it's pretty hard to get rid of those squirrels. I'll tell you that right now. I've got a lot of them in my lawn. And the snow's so high, they can walk right up to the bird feeder and just jump right in anymore. Joanne in Fitchburg, your turn. Hi, Joanne.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about my crab apple tree.
Okay.
Well, last year, you know, it's about 10 years old. It had these offshoots from below the roots, so it was two different color. The original was of, you know, red. And then it had green on the side. So one of you, I had called you earlier, either you or one of your colleagues suggested to cut it all the way up to down to the root and cover it up with the mulch. And that's what I did last year in the month of May and the spring, and left it. So I just had a few twigs, but I cut them off, and I have a high mulch up there. So what should I do this year now?
You still have the main trunk coming out?
Main trunk is still there, yeah.
Okay. So you got a fruit tree. What you want to do is wondering what to do with all those suckers in that?
Yeah.
Well, again, this May, cut them off again. But every time you mow your lawn, go out there and rub off any new growth that occurs. And if you keep doing that, and you've unfortunately got a rootstock that is very prolific in terms of producing water sprouts. Some varieties do more than souls, and some of the old ones we had were very commonly prone to that. So that's what your problem is. But regular pruning is about all you can do to keep it down.
All right. Thanks, Joanne. Thank you for calling. Joe in Chippewa Falls. Hi, Joe.
Yeah, I've got some seeds I bought from the Seavers Exchange.
And yep.
One is a downy sunflower and some milkweed and butterfly weed and that kind of stuff. And it says that in order to germinate, refrigerate. Is there anything at a certain temperature or something that something has to germinate at? Well, I usually find that if I take it outside in the spring and it don't germinate in the house, a lot of times the warmer temperatures.
Well, what it's doing is some seeds need a chilling period. Acorns, perfect example.
Well, that's why I figured nuts would crack, but these are a long way from nuts.
Yeah, I know it, but there are a lot of seeds that have that. It's actually a protective mechanism. They have to go through a chilling period before they will germinate, and that's usually about 90 days at 30 degrees or something like that.
Oh, so you really don't do like the nuts and try and freeze them?
No, if you just keep them chilled. And then in the spring, you plant them out, and hopefully their chilling requirement will have been met.
Between like 30 and 50?
Degrees?
Yeah.
You like someplace between 30 and 39 degrees, refrigerator.
So fairly, so they could even be frozen.
Yes, but then if we really get into this scientifically, there's a hormone called gibberellic acid in there, and you want to be breaking that down. Mm. Once it freezes, it breaks down very slowly because you have a slow chemical reaction. That's why the most productive temperature is usually between 34 and 39 degrees.
Oh, so keep it just above freezing then.
Yep.
Yep.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Joe. And let's go to Patty in Fond du Lac County next. Hi, Patty.
Hello. I am calling because I am one of the Fond du Lac County Master Gardeners, and we are having Mr. Tomish come and speak to us on March 8th for our annual Day in the Garden seminar.
Cool.
And I want to bring some of my apple branches to do the grafting class, and I don't know exactly for sure. I know a little bit about it, but I've never done it, and I don't know what size. Can I use water sprouts? Do they... the size, like the size of your finger. I got some of it, but not all of
it. Send me an email and I'll send you a little bulletin on that one.
I can do that.
What we're looking for grafting is nothing coming off the roots. You want it to come off the branch or the trunk, and it's those water sprouts that come off. They grow very rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
The best diameter is pencil diameter because the rootstock that I have available is pencil diameter.
Okay.
And those are very vigorous. You want buds to be on that. We call that cyanwood, and that makes the best grafting material.
How long in length do I need to cut this?
Well, usually for storage purposes, I cut them in about 1 foot length.
Okay.
But they can come in any size, and you're early enough that you could almost cut them in the morning and bring them to class.
Oh, okay.
And I'll look at them and say, yeah, no, that one won't work.
I'll just bring a whole basket full, and you tell me which ones work.
Okay, and the piece that you end up using is usually only about 2-3 inches long.
Really?
Yeah.
Holy cow. Okay, well, it's going to be a lot of fun that day, and I'm looking forward to it.
Sounds like a lot of fun. Thanks, Patty.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it very much. Your email was R.J. Tomish, isn't
right.
it? R.J. and Tomish is T-O-M-E-S-H, right?
Right.
At?
WISC, W-I-S-C dot E-D-U.
Okay, R.J. Tomish.
Right. There's about two, three email addresses floating around, but they keep making them shorter and shorter, and that's the shortest one.
That's the shortest one. Okay. And more callers online here, but there's some open lines. You can join us at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Travis in Appleton is next. Let's go to Travis. Hi.
Hey, my question was mainly in regards to herbs and in specific basil. I love basil, obviously, and it's a wonderful herb, but growing it I've always had troubles with. It's not one that you can really grow indoors all the time because it just, I feel that it gets too big, and then the leaves aren't as good, and it flowers, and I guess I was just looking for a little bit of suggestions on how to grow basil year-round, because I like fresh basil all year-round.
Well, growing it in outdoors is usually a lot easier. And one secret for harvesting, and I know you just alluded to one problem, is that it loses its flavor. Mm-hmm. Your most flavor is going to be on the new succulent growth, either at the tips or in the axils of branches as they emerge. Once you move these indoors, we have a drier environment, and you can move basil plants from outside in. You have a few, once you get past the insect issues and the aphids and all the other things. But the whole secret is to keep them watered regularly. Our light intensity is not really that great during the winter months, so you need to move them to a south window, or better yet, have a set of lights about 4 or 5 inches over, which would be a fluorescent light and a regular incandescent, so you get the full wavelength. And then water regularly, and then just continuously harvest the new growth, and that'll probably give you your best handle. There are some real interesting gimmicks out there, or planting beds, and some work very well.
Yeah. All right.
As far as harvesting, though, just a little follow-up. Where exactly, which ones should you harvest first? As far as the leaves, where do you start? From the bottom, from, the new shoots that come out? Do you ever snip the flowers off?
You snip the flowers off because that's a terminal growth, and it's not good. And once you snip that, then the buds below it are going to branch out, and those buds are going to give you nice succulent leaves. You want to, if you're going to eat anything, you'll like those new leaves that are less than a couple weeks old.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks, Travis. Sally in Wayland, Minnesota is up next. Hi, Sally.
Hey, you guys. How you doing today?
Great. Thanks for calling.
The days are getting longer.
They are getting longer.
Oh, yeah. the reason I'm calling is I need to know, where do you get your rootstock for grafting your apples?
Well, there are some nurseries. At one time, you almost looked at any nursery catalog and you could find them.
Yeah.
Now you probably have to go on the internet and Google. There's a nursery, St. Lawrence Nursery in Potsdam, New York. It's a place to get some rootstock. You might not find it. He's got a catalog on the internet, and then, or you can call out there or send him an email, or you can do a web search. I usually work directly with some nurseries because I use a fairly large volume, and when I say you have to put an order in of at least 100 to 500 before they even look at you.
Yeah.
So that's how I usually get my material.
So St. Lawrence Nursery.
I would check with that one because I spoken directly to him last year. People were asking me about that, and there are a few other places you have to buy 5 at a time or something like that.
Yeah, they're quite expensive. There's so many places that don't even do their own grafting anymore. Everything is being outsourced. It's kind of a bummer.
Yeah, but finding, and if you're buying rootstock, sometimes people tell me they're very cheap. Well, they're cheap or inexpensive because they're very small. You almost have to grow them a year or two in your garden before you have something big enough to graft on. The other thing is look at the rootstocks that they're providing. If you're in a sandier area, you might want to look at something that's more tolerant, like 111 or 26. But if you want the nice short ones, I do like Budavosky, a B9 series right now.
They do B9, not, and the 111 and 26, that's mauling?
Those are maulings.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So those are just a few of those that you might want to take a look at. But when you get down to the 111s, 106, you're looking at some larger tree stature. The smaller ones would be the Bud 9 series, which we're probably looking at about a half-size tree, very precocious. There's an Ottawa 3 series. That one's hard to find. It's difficult to graft on, but it's got some very unique winter hardy characteristics. But that's a trade-off.
Trade-off.
Yeah, actually, I'll try them all and see what does best for this area.
You want to try?
Thank you very much.
There's a new G series, like G30, that's coming out of New York. And if you find a place out there, there's a G16. We've tried G30. We've had very good luck in the state, and we're starting to recommend that one.
Okay.
And, again, what we're looking for is something that doesn't produce a lot of those water sprouts. We've already had 3 or 4 calls on that. Our suckers, excuse me, coming off the trunk area. And that was very common of some of the earlier dwarf roots. Excellent. Yeah, try them out. Find out what works well in your area.
And call us back.
I will, actually. I will. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Sally. Joe in Oregon, your turn. Hi, Joe.
Hi, you guys. Had a question about with the type of winter we're having in the spring. Is this a good time to start trimming apple trees, and what height would you want to trim them at?
Well, first of all, it's directed to, there's a very good bulletin on apple management in Wisconsin, and it'll talk about what to be pruning. You want to be, there's a little bit of science to it. You want to be saving scaffold branches. You want to remove branches that grow into the canopy. The whole idea is when you're done pruning is to allow more sunlight into that canopy so you have larger fruit and a more productive and healthier apple tree. So, yes, this is the right time to be out there doing it, but don't say, well, I've got a nice sharp knife here or pruning shears and we're going to go out and do it. You should have some reason for why you're making those cuts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. One other thing. Years ago, before we built our house out here, we started planting trees and we planted a couple of apple trees. And the deer, since we weren't out here a lot, the deer just destroyed them.
Yeah.
You know, and I just thought, oh, man, these are done. But I did dig them up, and I moved them. And it turns out these trees grew up nice, and they actually produce fruit. Problem is they're in a spot where they're just kind of surrounded by big, tall pine trees. And so it's about the only thing I can do is cut the pine trees down if I want to get some decent fruit off these trees.
Yep.
About it.
Yeah.
And how movable are trees if you had a spade?
What's the trunk diameter?
Well,
let me just go like this. Usually you can get in a tree spade. We're talking about a mechanical one.
Yeah.
They'll move up to about a 6-inch trunk diameter.
Oh, okay.
And there are several services around Madison, Milwaukee area that provide that service.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Joe. Gail in Hazelhurst, your turn. Hi, Gail.
Hi. I have a question about slugs. I live in northern Wisconsin, and I have a perennial garden that is surrounded by grass and also woods. And it's impossible to eliminate the spaces where they hide because the slugs hide in the perennial crowns. They hide just along where the grass is, where it meets the soil line. And I was wondering, I have two different kinds, and I was wondering if the slug adults survive the winter up here, or is it just the eggs that will keep everything going the next year?
They're both.
Oh. Yeah. Oh, okay.
One little suggestion that you might want to try is every time you see a toad someplace, bring them to your perennial flower bed. They live on slugs.
Yeah. Okay, because I pick them off. I use beer. I sprayed them with diluted vinegar, and I'm just wondering if removing the adults is going to help, or am I just...
No, they are very prolific.
I know they are.
And they multiply very fast, and if you have any type of mulch, they love that because they not only they feed on the decomposing material as well as healthy plant material, and they even are pick and choose, you know, I like that perennial, but not that one. So it's a whole host of problems. There are some slug baits out there. There are granular forms that you might want to try.
Yeah.
But it's a problem you're dealing with.
Okay.
Diatomaceous earth, will that help?
Yes. Well, that kind of rubs them the wrong way, but then that, you know, when it gets wet a few times, it washes down into the mulch.
I understand copper strips, too, but my garden is so big, there's no way that I can do that.
Yeah. All right, Gail, good luck.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Oh, boy. Bob in Sparta. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I am curious. I have a lot of cherry trees on my property, and I'm curious about grafting cultivars onto them. I'm wondering if there's any drawbacks to that, such as the trees growing too large to actually harvest the fruits, or if you have any comments on that.
Okay, the cherries you have growing, I assume, are the native cherry?
They are.
Yeah. First of all, the compatibility, you have two different species here, and so grafting on the cultured cherries onto those is probably not going to work because you're too far removed genetically, and so that'll be a problem. The other issue with cherries is that we really do not have any real hardy cherry varieties, except for a few like North Star and Meteor, and there's a few more that are starting to come online. But again, they are very selective as to the type of rootstock that they're compatible to. So basically, what you have in mind isn't going to work.
Okay. All right. Sorry about that. Thanks for calling, though, Bob. Bob Tomisch, our guest today, senior lecturer in the Department of Horticulture at UW-Madison and with UW Extension. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And you heard Neil Conan inviting you just a minute ago to come to Wisconsin Public Radio. I've been informed that he had been ill, but he's better now, and so he definitely will plan to be here on this coming Sunday from 10 to noon. And he'll be there, and Jim Packard and I'll be there, and Michael Feldman and Ben Marins, Joey Cardine, all kinds of people, just to have some fun, visit with you. And it's a free admission, of course, and everybody's welcome. That's the seventh floor of Vilas Hall, corner of Park Street and University Avenue in Madison. So I hope you can make it. Anna in Twin Lakes, I believe, is next. Anna, hi.
Hi, thank you. I have some jasmine trees. I absolutely love jasmine trees, but I have two problems with them. Number one, they're starting to flower, and which is beautiful, but when you hit the tree, everything falls off. All the petals fall off, the leaves fall off, but they're stable in other places. Like you can take some branches and pull on them and nothing comes off, but you hit the flowers and they'll fall out, which is kind of defeats the purpose of having them. And number two is they're in the same pot, and I want to take one of the trees and move it into a different pot, but with them flowering, I'm not sure when I should do this. So what can I do to keep the flowers, and then when should I repot the other one?
Well, repotting is going to send a little stress issue to the whole thing, but when you decide to repot, just simply assume that it's going to be probably 3 weeks or a month before you'll have any more blossoms on it. The reason they're falling off is there's probably your house is relatively dry right now, and those flowers are what receives the water the last. And so I try to maybe look at where you located those plants away from any heat ducts or wind movement or anything like that is going to help a little bit. But when it comes to transplanting, just simply pick a day, do it. Now's probably the better time of the year to be doing it. We usually figure transplanting in January through about March for houseplants is probably your best maneuver. After that, when the days are longer and they're moving themselves into a lot of good vegetative growth, and doing it this time of year will kind of ease them into that whole growth factor.
All right. Thanks, Anna. Appreciate the call. Frank and Prairie du Chien, your turn. Hi, Frank.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I had a question about starting an asparagus bed.
Sure.
And growing it.
Yes, go ahead.
What's the best location and best way to get going?
Okay, a few things. Asparagus likes good organic matter, and you should be working that into the soil. You should try to get rid of any grasses or any perennial weeds that are in that bed. We often tell people, if you're going to plant this spring, we should have started last fall.
Yeah.
But those of us that don't do that, a few things. You want to knock down the weed tissue that's there. Either as soon as things start greening up, if you want to go the Roundup or some type of herbicide, that'll knock down any vegetative growth. Start tilling it. Work in some good organic matter. And then when you actually get right down to planting, I'd dig a trench about a foot deep, put in about 3 inches of good composted material, even if you have to buy it. And then set your asparagus plants, spread them out on there, cover them with about an inch of soil, not very much. And as they grow and you have a couple of sprigs, then start filling that trench in. And then mulching over the top when you're all done. It takes a couple of years to get that bed of asparagus started. You want to have definitely full sun, fairly good drainage. There are a couple of issues to look at. There's a very good bulletin from the University of Minnesota that talks about establishing an asparagus bed. And I'm sure if you did an internet search, you'd find many others. And they'll give you hints that kind of equate to what I've kind of suggested.
All right.
Yep, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Frank. Ross in Lansing, Iowa. Hi.
How are you?
Good. Thank you for calling. What can we do for you?
I would like to ask your guest about his computer address. So I'm 84 years old. I didn't catch it when you...
Oh, okay. We can give that again. We'll do that. Have you got your pen handy there, or pencil?
Right, I do.
All right. It's RJTOM.
I've got his name.
Oh, ESH. Okay. @ WISC.
WISC.
.edu.
E like an Edward, D like a dog, U like an uncle.
Yep, that's for education.
Okay. So and now can I ask him a question?
Sure.
Mutsu, are you familiar with the triploid mutsu?
Oh, on the plum?
No, on the apple.
On the apple, okay. The triploid, you're talking about the chromosome level. And what's your question?
Well, can you grow it? I'm in just about a straight west line from Madison. And I noticed that the catalog, I think it's Miller Brothers up in New York, had it in their catalog last year, and that must be up in the Lake District. And if they have it in the catalog, it should be good for this area. And I have never seen it around here in farm stands or at...
Yeah. Well, there's two problems. And I think if it says a triploid on there, you need to have triploid pollen. And there's only about three or four different apples that have that triploid characteristic. And so you got to have one there as a pollinator. That's one issue. The other problem is zoning. If you look, I'm sure University of Iowa has bulletins on fruit cultivars, and it'll list those that are number one hardy for an area. The other issue is how long it takes to mature that fruit. I work with some grape varieties that have, and it takes 180 days to ripen, and that's snowfall and snowflaw.
Yeah.
As we look at, and these are some of the New York varieties. So how long it takes to mature. In your area, they might work. I'm not that familiar with it, but I know it has to have some pollination problems.
These columnar apples that, you know, is single staff going up in the apple in a pot.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking
about. All right. What part of that is the part that makes it do that?
Well,
so can you get that section? Sorry?
Well, you got to almost buy those directly. They're heavily patented, and they're grafted onto specific rootstock, but they're actually a genetic characteristic, and that's why they're patented, that they do not grow branches at all. They have just short little spurs. And I've got a couple of them at one of the research stations, and one does have fruit on. The other problem is, at least for here in Wisconsin, I'm sure you might be suffering from the same problem. Some winters are just a little too tough on those.
So where does the fruit come if there's no branches coming out?
Well, there's real short little stubby branches, and there's still spurs on the branches.
I gotcha.
So I've got a tree that's probably 8 feet tall at one of the research stations, and it's maybe 2.5 feet wide.
Oh.
It's called a columnar. They're looking at those, and then also the other thing I've observed is they're not that productive. But for a homeowner, small space, they actually talk about them as a container type plant where you can move the container around, and that they're small statured, grow very slowly.
Interesting. Thanks, Russ.
Thank you.
Appreciate the call. Suzanne in Madison, your turn. Hi, Suzanne.
Hello.
Hi.
I've got a quick question. I have a magnolia tree in my backyard named Butterfly,
okay.
Which is in it, and it sets blossoms. My only problem is, and they make it through the winter, something either eats them or just loves to knock them off and let them drop to the ground. Any ideas?
You're talking about the flowers.
Yeah, just the flower bud.
Well, their flowers are so big on those things, and they're very poorly attached, and you have about a 2-day window when they look beautiful. And if we have any wet or windy weather, they're gone. So I usually encourage people, if you're going to try planting a magnolia, try to pick a protected side of your house or in an area where you don't have as much wind, and that'll help a little
bit. It's before they bloom.
Oh, the buds are falling down?
Yeah, and they almost look like somebody took a bite out of them and tossed them.
Well, that probably might be happening. I'd check out squirrels or something like
that. You're thinking more of a squirrel or than a bird.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll get that little guy then.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Suzanne. Bob, can you recommend a catalog of apple trees which have good pictures in them?
Oh, boy, I didn't bring that along with me, but there's Hilltop Nursery has a very nice selection of materials. Stark Brothers, one of the oldest fruit producer providers in the country, they have a very good catalog. Sometimes I've gone just on the internet and ordered four or five, and I probably got two dozen in my office right now. But and sometimes the internet they'll do you just they'll get, you know, have some pretty nice pictures of materials by doing a search, and you pick a variety, and they'll show you what it looks like and things like that. So shopping
there.
Around, yeah.
Bob Tomisch, our guest today, senior lecturer in the Department of Horticulture at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and the University of Wisconsin Extension. Glad you're with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Bob Tomisch. Just a little housekeeping here. We had planned to have from 12 o'clock to 12:30, Rosemary Harris on Connecticut Master Gardener, who is also a mystery writer. She's written a fun book called Pushing Up Daisies. It's a mystery, but it has some gardening stuff in it, too. Unfortunately, there's some weather out east that is preventing. She's actually in the air in an airplane right about now, so she wasn't able to do the show with us. But we are going to reschedule her, and we'll have her back again some other time between 12 and 12:30 on Garden Talk. I enjoyed her book a lot, so we'll get her back, and hopefully we'll have some better weather for her. And in the meantime, let's go to Deborah in Milwaukee. Hi, Deb. Thank you for calling.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, I have some unusual pine cones that I got around Christmas time at a local store. And I've tried finding a book that will identify the cones. And
yeah.
I'm having a hard time. Some of them are huge. The four pines that were in the bag were Jeffrey, Lodgepole, Sugar, and a Ponderosa. And I think that I ended up finding out the largest ones were like about almost a foot in length. I would say maybe 8 inches. And I extracted some of the seeds and given some away because I have a neighbor whose daughter is studying horticulture.
Mm-hmm.
And they have little pine trees growing in their house, but in containers. But anyway, I like trying to start them myself, and I'm wondering if I do get these started, do you have any tips for that, and will they end up growing in this climate or soil, even if I, augment the soil here or, add peat moss or something to it, but what kind of book? My other question is, what's the best possible resource book for trees that has actual photographs?
You're trying to identify the large one you have. I'm guessing is a sugar pine, and that one is not going to survive up here. It's just it's a California, down in that zone area. It's got very large pine cones, and people often see that. Oh, that's from the giant redwood. Well, the giant redwood actually has a very small cone, but I'm guessing that's what you have. The ponderosa and some of those should germinate. Lodgepole, maybe. Not Germany, but I mean survive the winter that you have here. But you can start those indoors. A good potting soil mixture for starting seedlings works best because it's finely ground and it'll do well as long as you keep them wet.
Well, if I put it in, the old paper towel in the glass trick with water, will that?
Well, what's going to happen when you start doing that is, yes, you'll get germination, but when you have to move it to soil somewhere along the way, and when doing so, those small roots are very fragile and they're very apt to break. So I would just simply go the route of starting them indoors. And some just like you would any other seeds, keep the area relatively moist. You might want to put a cover on it until you see the little seedlings emerge, but kind of go that route.
Okay.
And how about the book? Good reference book?
That I don't have for you. I'm sure if you do a little internet search or go in and look under dendrology, that's a study of trees, and you might find something in there. I've seen stuff from time to time. on that. Just think, remember, good old Mother Nature just lets the seeds fall and they do germinate. And when we're starting those in little potting mixes and that type of thing, they're getting the water when they need it, and they're getting the light when they need it, and they're not having any little critter dig them up and chew them off.
Well, the book is actually for, because I love identifying trees, and I realize there's so many more. It's not as easy as it looks. I mean, you try to identify a tree, and you find yourself, and looking in the books that I do have, I think, oh my goodness, and they're like drawings; they're not actual pictures. And it's hard to figure out one from another. And there's a lot of different varieties of the same species. So I really would like a good resource book. I think if there isn't one out there, somebody can fill that niche.
I don't have that, but I'm sure they're out there because back. When I took a dendrology course, I can remember one we had was very helpful, and I can't remember the name of it anymore, Larry. It was only 2 years ago, right? So I would do a little – go down to your regular library or do a little internet search, and you might be able to find something. There's even some – sometimes in some of these southwestern states, they even have extension bulletins on some of those subjects.
Thank you.
I just did a quick look here on Google, under identify tree varieties is what I typed in, and there's a – there's a site called What Tree Is That?
What Tree Is That? Oh, okay.
And it's got some pictures and so forth, so you may be able to identify it off that website.
Oh, wow, great. Thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Don in Warren, Illinois, it's your turn. Hi, Don.
Well, now we're on what plant is this?
Okay.
Okay, in May issue of National Geographic, it did a very extensive article on Jamestown, and it started out with saying everything you learned in school about Jamestown is wrong. And one of it was a population of Indians that were native and living there. And one of the things it been bugging me is the fact that they said that in bad times when they had drought or other crop failures, they dug a plant called Tuckahoe, T-U-C-K-A-H-O-E. I looked in the Webster's unabridged, and they knew less about it than I do. There must have been a volume. They said they called it Indian loaf or Indian bread. What in the world is Tuckahoe?
Well, I've heard of it, but I can't answer your question. It's probably some type of starchy root that they do have. I do a little... maybe go out to some of the East Coast campuses and just do a little searching on history in there, and you might be able to find that one.
Okay. Okay, thank
Sorry
you.
I can't
All right,
that
thanks
one.
A lot. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And let's see, who's next here? Jerry in Madison is next. Hi, Jerry.
I'm very thankful for your program. I have two questions. One is the proper pruning of apple trees. I have maybe 25 apple trees, and it seems the more I prune them, the more they sprout. And somewhere I read that you're supposed to only prune about one-third every year, and I'm wondering which third. And then the second question deals with the proper use of lime sulfur, when and so forth.
Okay. Lime sulfur, I'll answer that one first. That's for controlling your scab. And if you, there's a bulletin on controlling fruit diseases in apples, and that'll tell you. And actually, when you start spraying the lime sulfur, as soon as you start seeing any bud swelling on the plants, you want to, because those apple scab is your biggest problem, those spores are going to start emerging sometime in May, and you want to have the protection there. And also, you have to apply that on every 7 to 10 day basis, or after any time we have a rain more than a half an inch, and you're talking about the entire season. So that's a pest control issue. When it comes to pruning an apple tree, there's a very good bulletin that's going to tell you what you should be saving. What you're doing is training that tree so that you have specific scaffold branches saved, and you want to have them spaced out so that the tree is symmetrical, well balanced, and you have ample light coming in. When it says take out one-third of the tree, that's a suggestion that when you have a tree that hasn't been pruned for a long time, you don't just want to come in there and make it perfect. You want to only take out about one-third of the woody plant material, and you want to spread that over the entire tree structure if you possibly can.
Now, this article seemed to imply you take one-third of the suckers off.
You take all the suckers are coming off the ground around the rootstock. You take all of those off.
No, I meant on the branches.
Those are
water sprouts, yeah.
And water sprouts, all those, once you get into annual pruning, and pruning is something you do every year, take all the water sprouts off, and then what you're then taking out are branches that maybe want to grow inward, or branches that cross over each other,
yeah,
or blocking the sun, per se. But I would... Looking at the question that you're asking, I would try to get a hold of the bulletin Growing Apples in Wisconsin. It's available on the internet. You can get it at your local county extension office, and it's going to have four or five pages in there about the training of a tree, and that'll probably give you a good starting point.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for calling.
You bet.
Bye-bye. Appreciate the call. I did a quick search on Tuckahoe as a plant. And actually, it was a word used by the Indians to denote a plant whose roots were edible, and it was a food source. And the area in which those plants grew was called Tuckahoe area. So it was a general term to refer to plants whose roots were edible. So it wasn't necessarily a specific
plant,
but it referred to the plants, the area in which the plants grew.
Yeah, and it could have been, Tuckahoe could have been a marsh area where they're eating cattail roots or anything like that.
Yeah, and so there's a Tuckahoe, New York, and there's a Tuckahoe River and Tuckahoe Lake, and there's a whole bunch
of... sunflowers, there are certain varieties of wild sunflowers that have like a tuberous root-type structure that people eat too, so...
Yep, so there you have it. Martha in Madison, your turn. Hi, Martha.
Hi. I have some more on the Tuckahoe.
Okay.
It's in an American Heritage Dictionary, probably 50s or 40s.
Oh, okay. What have you got?
It is indeed. It has various plants or plant parts used by American Indians as food, edible root of certain arums, A-R-U-M-S.
Okay, A-R-U-M-S.
Yes, or sclerotium. S-T-L-E-R-O-T-I-U-M of certain fungi.
Mm-hmm. Sclerotium are the overwintering parts of mushrooms and that type of thing.
And they say it's from the Algonquin, Virginia.
Right.
Tuckahoe.
And sometimes you find those when you buy sunflower seeds once in a while. You find this dark little thing in there, and it tastes terrible, and that's actually a sclerotium that when they did the harvesting somehow got into there. It's an overwintering. It's a very long-lived type of certain part of the life cycle of a mushroom.
Oh.
And not all mushrooms have it, but certain ones. What was the other part? Oh, the arums. Those are certain families of plants that have more succulent roots, and some of those are spring flowering plants. And so they probably consumed some of those storied structures. I wouldn't just eat anyone. There are some that are a little toxic. You only eat once.
Martha, thank you.
Sure, you're welcome.
Yeah, appreciate the help. Donna in Madison, your turn. Hi, Donna.
Hi, Larry and guest. I recently received a bunch of tulip bulbs that my son picked up when he was in layover in the Netherlands. And I can't put them in my refrigerator. They have such a strong odor, chemical odor. So I have them in the garage, kind of wrapped up in a rug. Is that going to be safe for the winter?
Well, it's going to be safe from here on out, probably. If you have an area of the garage that's not, freezes, and you might even want to place them in a cooler to give you a little more protection. And just to hold them, and then as soon as the ground thaws, get out there and plant. The odors that you're smelling on there are probably different types of fungicides that were put on. If you look, they have kind of a bluish or greenish hue, and some of those can be a little strong. Some people are more sensitive to those odors than others.
Yep. Okay, Donna,
and
there you have it.
And they go in the ground as soon as the ground is ready.
Yep.
As soon as it thaws.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Somebody wondered, Jeff in Chilton wondered about the cold hardiness zones, but more specifically, does the minimum temperatures, when they talk about cold hardiness zones, does that include wind chill or is it just the actual low temperature?
It's the actual low temperature. The wind chill factor has to come with loss of heat from, like a body or something like that. So it's the actual low temperature, like this morning when it said it was, I don't know, 6 below. It was 15 yesterday. Yeah, we're getting down there, where some plants are going to start toughing it out.
Let's go to Scott in Waterford. Hi, Scott.
Hello.
The situation we have here is our back of our house faces north, and we have a flower bed against the back of the house. And during the summer when it's warm and humid and the sun doesn't get fully on all the way down on the back of the house, we seem to get a moss that develops in the garden, and somehow it seems to vaporize when it's humid onto the back of the house, and it, just about every summer I end up having to pressure wash the vinyl siding on the back of the house to get this moss off. And if you go through the neighborhood, you can see on the north side of a lot of the homes, you have the same problem. Now, I've tried using just regular weed killer on the moss. It seems to control it, kill it off a while, but it always seems to come back. I was wondering if there's something else I can use to completely wipe this out, or is that just something I'm going to have to live with?
Well, the reason it keeps coming back is you don't wash off all the spores, and there's always spores being released from the moss that is there.
Okay.
And over time, it probably selected a nice strain of some type of moss that's doing well. If you talk to builders, there are certain paints that have materials in it. I believe it's copper-based types of paints that mm-hmm. will keep some of those mosses from growing there. The other thing is try to keep your vegetation away from that side of the house where you get better air movement and you have fewer moss problems.
And I know sometimes builders will put copper strips along rooftops, for example, to keep the moss off of roofs. Mm. I don't know if you could do it with siding or not, but a copper strip.
Right. It's the copper that has the impact on the moss. And there was something else you had said. Oh, herbicides don't really do well on mosses because it'll knock out the chlorophyll structure for a little bit. But they're structurally, they don't have a root system, and that's usually what most herbicides impact.
Okay, so there's really nothing that will really take control of them. And
No, I would go to a place, the paint store, someplace like that. I mean, not just a box store paint store, but a paint store that can do a little digging for you.
Okay.
All right, thanks.
Thank you.
Appreciate the call. On to Don in Brownsville, Minnesota next. Let's go to Don. Hi, thank you for calling.
Yeah, thank you, Larry. I have a question about trees. Hello?
Yep.
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. First, before I start the tree question, on that question about slugs, I probably have the best slug collection in the world on my property. And I haven't had any problems with them for at least 6 years now, and they're still around. But I found that using silicone sand around the base of my plants, the slugs will not walk on it. If they do, they die.
It's like the diatomaceous earth. It's irritating on them and actually punctures.
Right. They lose all their water in their body
right.
from walking on it. And I found it works. It's in this very green safe. You just got added on once a year, and that's, you know, after you plant your plants.
Mm-hmm.
But anyhow, that the question I have is I have a little hobby farm of about 30 acres, and about the only tree I can grow on it is a box elder tree. And I have grown some green ash. That seems to be doing all right. I have access to the state of Minnesota tree farms, and I've bought 500 tree lots probably 6 or 7 years in a row, and I have yet to get anything to grow. It's the clay.
Well,
do you know of anything that I could put in there, whether it be a tree or a bush that I can, you know?
Well, one of the things that's probably happening is there a lot of grasses of types growing in that area where you're trying?
No, I had the forestry department there, and they said that what happens, the tree will start growing in about 4 to 6 years, it dies. And they said what's happening is the root system is actually suffocating in the clay because there's no air down there.
Yeah, well, that's probably what you got a hard pan. Clay and the water's setting on top of that, and then you have fungal problems coming in.
Big time. Yeah. I've probably planted 6,000 trees, and out of the 6,000, I've only got the green ash to grow.
Yep. Well, green ash is one of the plants that tolerates wet conditions. So, one of the other things is look at an area adjacent to yours that's been wild for a number of years,
mm-hmm.
and look at what tree species are surviving there.
Those
have been natural selected, and so that would be some species you might want to try.
I see that oak seems to be doing good, but you can't plant them on the flat. You got to get on the side hills.
That's because there's drainage on the side hills.
Uh-huh. So I got about 5 or 6 acres is probably the only thing I'm going to be able to grow on there is grass, huh?
Probably. the other thing you can try doing is take a two-bottom plow and plow two furrows together so you get a ridge, and then plant your trees on that ridge. That'll allow for a certain amount of drainage, and that'll maybe help get them started.
Now, this particular piece of property here where I'm trying to grow it has been farmed for years.
Yeah.
And it seems like about 8 inches, and then when you get down to the 8 inches, it's solid clay.
Yep.
Yeah.
So it's just a water problem, and like I said, you could try just take one row and double furrow it together so you get kind of a ridge and disc it and plant on that ridge and see if that does help.
How can I maintain the water on that ridge? Because that clay, when it dries out, it gets hard as a rock.
I know it. If you want to, you could put a dripper line down that row of trees if you want to. And after a couple of years, I'll have an extensive enough root system that's going to be a survival that they should be able to make it.
I have access to a lot of bark because there's sawmills around here.
Bark chips, that's a good mulch.
Okay, would that be good to put around the trees?
Try it. It should work.
It's okay.
Bark mulch is always a good thing.
Thank you.
All right, thanks a lot, Don. Steve and Phillips, hi.
Hi. Once again, this 11 to 1230 hour, just great.
Thank you.
Anyway, what I've got is an old farmstead, and it's got some really old plum trees there that blossom every year, but nothing comes of them. And I was wondering if there is some way to salvage them, being, you know, that they're so old and that, and they're on kind of on the north side of a small woodlot, so I know they ain't getting quite the sun, probably. So I'd be willing to clean out that, you know, thin that out so they'd get more sun if there was some way to salvage them.
Yeah. Did they ever have good fruit on?
I don't know. I haven't been here that long.
Yeah. Some of those are just wild-type plums that are growing in that area. And they usually grow right along the margin of the woods because they get just enough sunlight to survive, and they actually do send up suckers, and so there's a real thick mass of those. If you want some plums, I would suggest starting from scratch.
Starting, okay.
And I would look at some of those, like pipes, like up in your area, there's Pipestone and Sulpeta. Some of the old South Dakota varieties have always been very good. University of Minnesota has a new one out called Alderman. It's got a fruit that's about 2 inches in diameter, very sweet, very tasty. We're kind of looking at it for the northern half of the state, and we'll see how well that does.
All right.
Does that spell with a E or an A, Alderman?
A.
A.
A-L-D-E-R-M-A-N. You're going to have to shop around for that one. It was patented, I think, in probably around the 1980s.
Okay.
And so some of the nurseries are just starting to carry it.
What were some of the other names of the ones that you mentioned?
Pipestone.
Pipestone?
Yep.
Okay.
Hey, I'll even do better for you.
You better hurry, though, because we've got a few seconds left.
Talk fast, huh? Pipestone, Sulpeta, Katoka, Oka. These are some old Indian names, and you see some of those. Yeah, I'd take a shot at some of those varieties. You'll find them in a lot of the catalogs, and it's a pretty good choice.
Bob, thanks.
Thank you.
Been a real pleasure. Bob Tomisch, our guest today, senior lecturer in the Department of Horticulture at UW-Madison and UW Extension. Joe Rhodes comes along on Monday to talk Apple computers, and then our weather guys will visit with us as well on Monday. Stay with us on the Ideas Network.